to bring the colour. That's what Miss Jessamine does.
It was awfully kind of her, Miss Jessamine, I mean, to lend me this dress. Sophie chuckled low in her throat.
Miss Jessamine's never worn it. Miss Bramwell gave it to her as a gift, but Miss Jessamine said it made her look sallow and tossed it in the back of her wardrobe.
Ungrateful, if you ask me.
Now, go on, then, and pinch your cheeks a bit. You're pale as milk.
Having done so, and having thanked Sophie, Tessa emerged from the bedroom into a long stone corridor. Charlotte was there, waiting for her. She set off immediately with Tessa behind her, limping slightly. The black silk shoes, which did not quite fit, were not kind to her bruised feet. Being in the Institute was a bit like being inside a castle, the ceiling disappearing up into gloom, the tapestries hanging on the walls. Or at least it was what Tessa imagined the inside of a castle might look like. The tapestries bore repeating motifs of stars, swords, and the same sort of designs she'd seen inked on Will and Charlotte. There was a single repeating image, too, of an angel rising out of a lake, carrying a sword in one hand and a cup in the other.
"This place used to be a church," Charlotte said, answering Tessa's unasked question.
"The Church of All Hallows the Less. It burned down during the Great Fire of London. We took over the land after that and built the Institute on the ruins of the old church. It's useful for our purposes to remain on consecrated ground."
"Don't people think it's odd, you building on the site of an old church like this?" Tessa asked, hurrying to keep up.
"They don't know about it. Mundanes, that's what we call ordinary people, aren't aware of what we do," Charlotte explained. "To them, from the outside, the place looks like an empty patch of land. Beyond that, mundanes aren't really very interested in what doesn't affect them directly." She turned to usher Tessa through a door and into a large, brightly lit dining room. "Here we are." Tessa stood blinking in the sudden illumination. The room was huge, big enough for a table that could have seated 20 people. An immense gasalier hung down from the ceiling, filling the room with a yellowish glow. Over a sideboard loaded with expensive-looking china, a gilt-framed mirror ran the length of the room. A low glass bowl of white flowers decorated the table's center. Everything was tasteful and very ordinary. There was nothing unusual about the room, nothing that might hint at the nature of the house's occupants. Though the entire long dining table was draped with white linen, only one end was set, with places for 5 people. Only 2 people were already sitting, Will and a fair-haired girl about Tessa's age in a shimmering low-necked gown. They appeared to be studiously ignoring each other. Will looked up in apparent relief when Charlotte and Tessa came in.
"Will," Charlotte said, "you remember Miss Gray?"
"My recollection of her," said Will, "is most vivid indeed." He was no longer wearing the odd black clothes he'd been wearing the day before, but an ordinary pair of trousers and a gray jacket with a black velvet collar. The gray made his eyes look bluer than ever. He grinned at Tessa, who felt herself flush and looked quickly away.
"And Jessamine. Jessie, do look up.
Jessie, this is Miss Teresa Gray. Miss Gray, this is Miss Jessamine Lovelace."
"So pleased to make your acquaintance," Jessamine murmured. Tessa couldn't help staring at her. She was almost ridiculously pretty. What one of Tessa's novels would have called an English rose, all silvery fair hair, soft brown eyes, and creamy complexion. She wore a very bright blue dress and rings on almost every one of her fingers. If she had had the same black skin markings that Will and Charlotte did, they weren't visible. Will cast Jessamine a look of plain loathing and turned to Charlotte.
"Where's your benighted husband, then?"
Charlotte, taking a seat, gestured for Tessa to sit opposite her in the chair beside Will.
"Henry's in his workroom. I've sent Thomas to fetch him. He'll be up in a moment."
"And Jem?"
Charlotte's look was warning, but...
"Jem is unwell," was all she said.
He's having one of his days.
He's always having one of his days, Jessamine sounded disgusted.
Tessa was about to inquire as to who Jem might be when Sophie entered, followed by a plump woman of middle age whose gray hair was escaping from a bun at the back of her head. The two of them began to serve food from the sideboard. There was roast pork, potatoes, savory soup, and fluffy dinner rolls with creamy yellow butter. Tessa felt suddenly lightheaded. She had forgotten how hungry she was. She bit into a roll, only to check herself when she saw Jessamine staring.
"You know," Jessamine said airily, "I don't believe I've ever seen a warlock eat before. I suppose you needn't ever bant, do you? You can just use magic to make yourself slender."
"We don't know for certain that she's a warlock, Jessie," said Will. Jessamine ignored him.
"Is it dreadful being so evil? Are you worried you'll go to hell?"
She leaned closer to Tessa.
"What do you think the devil's like?"
Tessa set her fork down. "Would you like to meet him? I could summon him up in a trice if you like, being a warlock and all." Will let out a whoop of laughter. Jessamine's eyes narrowed.
"There's no call to be rude," she began,
then broke off as Charlotte sat bolt upright with an astonished shriek.
"Henry!"
A man was standing in the dining room's arched doorway, a familiar-looking tall man with a shock of ginger hair and hazel eyes. He wore a torn tweed Norfolk jacket over a shockingly bright-striped waistcoat. His trousers were covered in what looked peculiarly like coal dust, but none of that was what had made Charlotte scream. It was the fact that his left arm appeared to be on fire. Little flames licked up his arm from a point above his elbow, releasing tendrils of black smoke.
"Charlotte, darling,"
Henry said to his wife, who was staring at him in gape-mouthed horror. Jessamine, beside her, was wide-eyed.
"Sorry I'm late. You know, I think I might nearly have the sensor working."
Will interrupted.
"Henry," he said, "you're on fire. You do know that, don't you?"
"Oh, yes," Henry said eagerly.
The flames were now nearly to his shoulder.
"I've been working like a man possessed all day. Charlotte, did you hear what I said about the sensor?"
Charlotte dropped her hand from her mouth.
"Henry," she shrieked, "your arm!"
Henry glanced down at his arm and his mouth dropped open.
"Bloody hell,"
was all he had time to say before Will, exhibiting a startling presence of mind, stood up, seized the vase of flowers off the table, and hurled the contents over Henry. The flames went out with a faint, protesting sizzle, leaving Henry standing soaking wet in the doorway, one sleeve of his jacket blackened, and a dozen damp white flowers strewn at his feet. Henry beamed and patted the burned sleeve of his jacket with a look of satisfaction.
"You know what this means?"
Will set the vase down.
"That you set yourself on fire and didn't even notice?"
"That the flame retardant mixture I developed last week works," Henry said proudly. "This material must have been burning for a good 10 minutes, and it isn't even half burned through."
He squinted down at his arm.
"Perhaps I ought to set the other sleeve on fire and see how long—"
"Henry," said Charlotte, who appeared to have recovered from her shock,
"if you set yourself on fire deliberately, I will institute divorce proceedings. Now sit down and eat your supper, and say hello to our guest."
Henry sat, glanced across the table at Tessa, and blinked in surprise.
"I know you," he said. "You bit me."
He sounded pleased about it, as if recollecting a pleasant memory they'd both shared. Charlotte shot a despairing look at her husband.
"Have you asked Miss Gray about the Pandemonium Club yet?" Will asked. "The Pandemonium Club."
"I know the words. They were written on the side of Mrs. Dark's carriage," Tessa said.
"It's an organization," Charlotte said. "A rather old organization of mundanes who have interested themselves in the magical arts.
At their meetings they do spells and try to summon up demons and spirits. She sighed. Jessamine snorted.
I can't imagine why they bother, she said. Messing about with spells and wearing hooded robes and setting little fires, it's ridiculous.
Oh, they do more than that, said Will. They're more powerful in Downworld than you might think. Many rich and important figures in mundane society are members.
That only makes it sillier, Jessamine tossed her hair.
They have money and power. Why are they playing around with magic?
A good question, said Charlotte. Mundanes who involve themselves in things they know nothing about are likely to meet unpleasant ends.
Will shrugged. When I was trying to track down the source of the symbol on that knife Gemini found in the alley, I was directed to the Pandemonium Club. The members of it, in turn, directed me to the Dark Sisters. It's their symbol, the two serpents. They supervise a set of secret gambling dens frequented by Downworlders. They existed to lure mundanes in and trick them into losing all their money in magical games. Then, when the mundanes fell into debt, the Dark Sisters would extort the money back at ruinous rates.
Will looked over at Charlotte. They ran some other businesses as well, most unsavory ones. The house in which they kept Tessa, I had been told, was a Downworlder brothel catering to mundanes with unusual tastes.
Will, I'm not at all sure, Charlotte began dubiously.
Hmph, Jessamine said. No wonder you were so keen to go there, William.
If she had hoped to annoy Will, it didn't work. She might as well not have spoken for all the attention he paid her. He was looking at Tessa across the table. His eyebrows arched slightly.
Have I offended you, Miss Gray? I imagined that after all you've seen, you would not be easily shocked.
I'm not offended, Mr. Herondale.
Despite her words, Tessa felt her cheeks flame.
Well-brought-up young ladies didn't know what a brothel was, and certainly wouldn't say the word in mixed company. Murder was one thing, but this...
I don't see how it could have been a place like that, she said as firmly as she could. No one ever came or went, and other than the maidservant and the coachman, I never saw anyone else who lived there.
No, by the time I got there, it was quite deserted, Will agreed. Clearly they had decided to suspend business, perhaps in the interests of keeping you isolated.
He glanced over at Charlotte.
Do you think Miss Gray's brother has the same ability she does? Is that perhaps why the Dark Sisters captured him in the first place?
Tessa interjected, glad for the change of subject.
My brother never showed any sign of such a thing, but then neither did I until the Dark Sisters found me.
What is your ability? Jessamine demanded. Charlotte won't say.
Jessamine, Charlotte scowled at her.
I don't believe she has one, Jessamine went on. I think she's simply a little sneak who knows that if we believe she's a Downworlder, we'll have to treat her well because of the Accords.
Tessa set her jaw. She thought of her Aunt Harriet saying, "Don't lose your temper, Tessa," and "Don't fight with your brother simply because he teases you." But she didn't care. They were all looking at her, Henry with curious hazel eyes, Charlotte with a gaze as sharp as glass, Jessamine with thinly veiled contempt, and Will with cool amusement. What if they all thought what Jessamine thought? What if they all thought she was angling for charity? Aunt Harriet would have hated accepting charity even more than she disapproved of Tessa's temper. It was Will who spoke next, leaning forward to look intently into her face.
"You can keep it a secret," he said softly. "But secrets have their own weight, and it can be a very heavy one."
Tessa raised her head. "It needn't be a secret, but it would be easier for me to show you than to tell you."
"Excellent!"
Henry looked pleased.
"I enjoy being shown things. Is there anything you require, like a spirit lamp or..."
"It's not a seance, Henry," Charlotte said wearily. She turned to Tessa. "You don't need to do this if you don't want to, Miss Gray." Tessa ignored her.
"Actually, I do require something.
She turned to Jessamine. Something of yours, please. A ring or a handkerchief? Jessamine wrinkled her nose.
Dear me, it sounds to me rather as if your special power is pickpocketing.
Will looked exasperated. Give her a ring, Jessie. You're wearing enough of them.
You give her something, then. Jessamine set her chin.
No, Tessa spoke firmly. It must be something of yours. Because of everyone here, you're the closest to me in size and shape. If I transform into tiny Charlotte, this dress will simply fall off me, Tessa thought. She had considered trying to use the dress itself, but since Jessamine had never worn it, Tessa wasn't sure the change would work and didn't want to take any chances.
Very well, then.
Petulantly, Jessamine detached from her smallest finger a ring with a red stone set in it and passed it across the table to Tessa.
This had better be worth the trouble.
Oh,
it will be.
Unsmiling, Tessa put the ring in the palm of her left hand and closed her fingers around it. Then she shut her eyes. It was always the same. Nothing at first, then the flicker of something at the back of her mind, like someone lighting a candle in a dark room. She groped her way toward it, as the Dark Sisters had taught her. It was hard to strip away the fear and the shyness, but she had done it enough times now to know what to expect. The reaching forward to touch the light at the center of the darkness, the sense of light and enveloping warmth, as if she were drawing a blanket, something thick and heavy, around herself, covering every layer of her own skin, and then the light blazing up and surrounding her, and she was inside it, inside someone else's skin, inside their mind, Jessamine's mind. She was only at the edge of it, her thoughts skimming the surface of Jessamine's, like fingers skimming the surface of water. Still, it took her breath away. Tessa had a sudden, flashing image of a bright piece of candy with something dark at its center, like a worm at the core of an apple. She felt resentment, bitter hatred, anger, a terrible, fierce longing for something. Her eyes flew open. She was still sitting at the table, Jessamine's ring clutched in her hand. Her skin zinged with the sharp pins and needles that always accompanied her transformations. She could feel the oddness that was the different weight of another body, not her own. Could feel the brush of Jessamine's light hair against her shoulders. Too thick to be held back by the pins that had clasped Tessa's hair, it had come down around her neck in a pale cascade.
By the angel, breathed Charlotte.
Tessa looked around the table. They were all staring at her, Charlotte and Henry with their mouths open, Will speechless for once, a glass of water frozen halfway to his lips. And Jessamine. Jessamine was gazing at her in abject horror, like someone who has seen a vision of their own ghost. For a moment, Tessa felt a stab of guilt. It lasted only a moment, though. Slowly, Jessamine lowered her hand from her mouth, her face still very pale.
Goodness! My nose is enormous! She exclaimed. Why didn't anyone tell me?
4. We are shadows. Pulvis et umbra sumus. Horace. Odes. The moment Tessa transformed back to her own shape, she had to suffer a barrage of questions. For people who lived in a shadow world of magic, the assembled Nephilim seemed surprisingly awed by her ability, which only served to underline what Tessa had already begun to suspect. That her shape-changing talent was exceedingly unusual. Even Charlotte, who had known about it before Tessa's demonstration, seemed fascinated.
So you must be holding something that belongs to the person you're transforming into?
Charlotte asked for the second time. Sophie and the older woman, who Tessa suspected was the cook,
had already taken away the dinner plates and had served fancy cake and tea, but none of the diners had touched it yet. "You can't simply look at someone and..."
"I explained that already." Tessa's head was beginning to hurt. "I must be holding something that belongs to them, or a bit of hair or an eyelash. Something that's theirs. Otherwise nothing happens."
"Do you think a vial of blood would do the trick?" Will asked in a tone of academic interest.
"Probably. I don't know. I've never tried it." Tessa took a sip of her tea, which had grown cold.
"And you're saying that the Dark Sisters knew this was your talent? They knew you had this ability before you did?" Charlotte asked.
"Yes. It's why they wanted me in the first place."
Henry shook his head. "But how did they know? I don't quite understand that part."
"I don't know," Tessa said, not for the first time. "They never explained it to me. All I know is what I told you, that they seemed to know exactly what it was I could do and how to train me to do it. They spent hours with me, every day."
Tessa swallowed against the bitterness in her mouth. Memories of how it had been rose up in her mind. The hours and hours in the cellar room at the dark house, the way they had screamed at her that Nate would die if she couldn't change as they wanted her to, the agony when she finally learned to do it.
"It hurt at first," she whispered, "as if my bones were snapping, melting inside my body. They would force me to change 2, 3, then a dozen times a day until I would finally lose consciousness. And then the next day, they'd start at it again. I was locked in that room, so I couldn't try to leave." She took a ragged breath. "That last day, they tested me by asking me to change into a girl who had died. She had memories of being attacked with a dagger, being stabbed, of something chasing her into an alley. Perhaps it was the girl Gemini found." Will sat up straight, his eyes shining. "Gemini guessed she must have escaped from an attack and run out into the night. I believe they sent the Shax demon after her to bring her back, but I killed it. They must have wondered what happened."
"The girl I changed into was named Emma Bayless," Tessa said in a half-whisper. "She had very fair hair, tied in little pink bows, and she was only a little thing."
Will nodded as if the description were familiar to him. "Then they did wonder what had happened to her. That's why they had me change into her. When I told them she was dead, they seemed relieved."
"The poor soul," Charlotte murmured. "So you can change into the dead, not only the living."
Tessa nodded. "Their voices speak in my mind when I change, too. The difference is that many of them can remember the moment they died."
"Ugh!" Jessamine shuddered. "How morbid!"
Tessa looked over at Will.
"Mr. Herondale," she chided herself silently, but it was hard to think of him that way.
She felt somehow as if she knew him better than she really did, but that was foolishness.
"You found me because you were looking for the murderer of Emma Bayless," she said. "But she was only one dead human girl. One dead, what do you call it? Mundane. Why so much time and effort to find out what happened to her?"
For a moment, Will's eyes met hers, his own a very dark blue. Then his expression changed. Only a slight change, but she saw it, though she could not have said what the change meant.
"Oh, I wouldn't have bothered," but Charlotte insisted. She felt there was something larger at work. "And once Jem and I infiltrated the Pandemonium Club and heard rumors of the other murders, we realized there was more going on than the death of one girl. Whether or not we like mundanes particularly, we can't allow them to be systematically slaughtered. It's the reason we exist."
Charlotte leaned forward across the table.
"The Dark Sisters never mentioned what use they intended to make of your abilities, did they?"
"You know about the Magister," Tessa said. "They said they were preparing me for him."
"For him to do what?" Will asked. "Eat you for dinner?"
Tessa shook her head.
To
To marry me, they said.
To marry you? Jessamine was openly scornful. That's ridiculous. They were probably going to blood sacrifice you and didn't want you to panic.
I don't know about that, Will said. I looked in several rooms before I found Tessa. I remember one that was done up surprisingly like a wedding chamber. White hangings on an enormous bed, a white dress hanging in the wardrobe. It looked about your size. He eyed Tessa thoughtfully. Ceremonial marriage can be a very powerful thing, Charlotte said. Performed properly, it could allow someone access to your ability, Tessa, even the power to control you. She drummed her fingertips thoughtfully on the tabletop. As for the Magister, I've researched the term in the archives. It is often used to denote the head of a coven or other group of magicians, the sort of group the Pandemonium Club imagines itself to be. I can't help but feel that the Magister and the Pandemonium Club are connected.
We've investigated them before and never managed to catch them doing anything dodgy, Henry pointed out. It isn't against the law to be an idiot.
Lucky for you, Jessamine said under her breath. Henry looked hurt, but said nothing. Charlotte cast Jessamine a freezing look.
Henry is right, said Will. It isn't as if Jem and I didn't catch them doing the odd illegal thing, drinking absinthe laced with demon powders and so forth. As long as they were only hurting themselves, it hardly seemed worth involving ourselves. But if they've graduated to harming others... Do you know who any of them are? Henry asked curiously. The mundanes, no, Will said dismissively. There never seemed a reason to find out, and many of them went masked or disguised at club events. But I recognize quite a few of the downworlders. Magnus Bane, Lady Belcourt, Ragnar Fell, De Quincey.
De Quincey?
I hope he wasn't breaking any laws. You know how much trouble we've had finding a head vampire we could see eye to eye with, fretted Charlotte.
Will smiled into his tea.
Whenever I saw him, he was being a perfect angel.
After a hard look at him, Charlotte turned to Tessa.
Did the servant girl you mentioned, Miranda, have your ability? Or what about Emma?
I don't think so. If Miranda did, they would have been training her as well, wouldn't they? And Emma didn't remember anything like that.
And they never mentioned the Pandemonium Club? Some larger purpose to what they were doing?
Tessa racked her brain. What was it the Dark Sisters had talked about when they thought she wasn't listening?
I don't think they ever said the name of the club, but they would talk sometimes about meetings they were planning on attending and how the other members would be pleased to see how they were getting on with me.
They did say a name once. Tessa screwed her face up, trying to remember.
Someone else who was in the club.
I don't remember, though I recall thinking the name sounded foreign.
Charlotte leaned forward across the table. Can you try, Tessa? Try to remember?
Charlotte meant no harm, Tessa knew, and yet her voice called up other voices in Tessa's head, voices urging her to try to reach into herself to draw out the power. Voices that could turn hard and cold at the slightest provocation. Voices that wheedled and threatened and lied.
Tessa drew herself upright.
First, what about my brother?
Charlotte blinked.
Your brother?
You said that if I gave you information about the Dark Sisters, you'd help me find my brother. Well, I told you what I knew, and I still don't have any idea where Nate is.
Oh.
Charlotte sat back, looking almost startled.
Of course. We'll start investigating his whereabouts tomorrow, she reassured Tessa.
We'll start with his workplace. Speak to his employer and find out if he knows anything. We have contacts in all sorts of places, Miss Gray. Downworld runs on gossip like the mundane world does. Eventually we'll turn up someone who knows something about your brother.
The meal ended not long after that, and Tessa excused herself from the table with a feeling of relief, declining Charlotte's offer to guide her back to her room. All she wanted was to be alone with her thoughts. She made her way down the torchlit corridor, remembering the day she had stepped off the boat at Southampton. She had come to England knowing no one but her brother, and had let the Dark Sisters force her into serving them.
Now she had fallen in with the Shadow Hunters, and who was to say they would treat her any better? Like the Dark Sisters, they wanted to use her for the information she knew. And now they were all aware of her power, how long would it be before they wanted to use her for that, too? Still lost in thought, Tessa nearly walked directly into a wall. She brought herself up short and looked around, frowning. She had been walking for much longer than it had taken her and Charlotte to reach the dining room, and still she hadn't found the room she remembered. In fact, she wasn't even sure she'd found the corridor she remembered. She was in a hallway now, lined with torches and hung with tapestries, but was it the same one? Some of the corridors were very bright, some very dim, the torches burning with varying shades of brightness. Sometimes the torches flared up and then faded as she passed, as if responding to some peculiar stimulus she couldn't see. This particular corridor was fairly dim. She picked her way to the end of it carefully, where it branched into two more, each identical to this one.
"Lost?" inquired a voice behind her, a slow, arrogant voice, immediately familiar.
"Will." Tessa turned and saw that he was leaning carelessly against the wall behind her as if he were lounging in a doorway, his feet in their scuffed boots crossed in front of him. He held something in his hand, his glowing stone. He pocketed it as she looked at him, dousing its light.
"You ought to let me show you around the Institute a bit, Miss Gray," he suggested. "You know, so you don't get lost again."
Tessa narrowed her eyes at him.
"Of course, you can simply continue wandering about on your own if you really wish to," he added. "I ought to warn you, though, that there are at least three or four doors in the Institute that you really shouldn't open. There's the one that leads to the room where we keep trapped demons, for instance. They can get a bit nasty. Then there's the weapons room. Some of the weapons have a mind of their own, and they are sharp. Then there are rooms that open onto empty air. They're meant to confuse intruders. But when you're as high as the top of a church, you don't want to accidentally slip and—"
"I don't believe you," Tessa said. "You're an awful liar, Mr. Herondale. Still—" she bit her lip. "I don't like wandering about. You can show me around if you promise no tricks." Will promised. And to Tessa's surprise, he was true to his word. He guided her down a succession of identical-looking corridors, talking as they walked. He told her how many rooms the Institute had, more than you could count. Told her how many Shadow Hunters could live in it at once, hundreds. And displayed for her the vast ballroom in which was held an annual Christmas party for the Enclave, which, Will explained, was their term for the group of Shadow Hunters who lived in London. In New York, he added, the term was Conclave. American Shadow Hunters, it seemed, had their own lexicon. After the ballroom came the kitchen, where the middle-aged woman Tessa had seen in the dining room was introduced as Agatha, the cook. She sat sewing in front of a massive kitchen range and was, to Tessa's intense mystification, also smoking an enormous pipe. She smiled indulgently around it as Will took several chocolate tarts from the plate where they had been left to cool on the table. Will offered one to Tessa. She shuddered. "Oh, no, I hate chocolate." Will looked horrified. "What kind of monster could possibly hate chocolate?" "He eats everything," Agatha told Tessa with a placid smile. "Since he was 12, he has. I suppose it's all the training that keeps him from getting fat." Tessa, amused at the idea of a fat Will, complimented the pipe-puffing Agatha on the mastery of the enormous kitchen. It looked like a place you could cook for hundreds, with row upon row of jarred preserves and soups, spice tins, and a huge haunch of beef roasting on a hook over the open fireplace. "Well done," Will said after they'd left the kitchen. "Complimenting Agatha like that. Now she'll like you. It's no good if Agatha doesn't like you. She'll put stones in your porridge." "Oh, dear," Tessa said, but she couldn't hide the fact that she was entertained. They went from the kitchen to the music room, where there were harps and a great old piano gathering dust.
Down a set of stairs was the drawing room, a pleasant place where the walls, instead of being bare stone, were papered with a bright print of leaves and lilies. A fire was going in a large grate, and several comfortable armchairs were pulled up near it. There was a great wooden desk in the room, too, which Will explained was the place where Charlotte did much of the work of running the institute. Tessa couldn't help wondering what it was that Henry Branwell did and where he did it. After that, there was the weapons room, finer than anything Tessa imagined you might see in a museum. Hundreds of maces, axes, daggers, swords, knives, and even a few pistols hung on the walls, as well as a collection of different kinds of armor, from greaves worn to protect the shins to full suits of chainmail. A solid-looking young man with dark brown hair sat at a high table polishing a set of short daggers. He grinned when they came in. "Evening, Master Will."
"Good evening, Thomas. You know Miss Gray," he indicated Tessa.
"You were at the Dark House," Tessa exclaimed, looking more closely at Thomas. "You came in with Mr. Branwell. I thought..."
"That I was a shadow hunter," Thomas grinned.
He had a sweet, pleasant, open sort of face, and a lot of curling hair. His shirt was open at the neck, showing a strong throat. Despite his obvious youth, he was extremely tall and muscular, the width of his arms straining against his sleeves.
"I'm not, miss, only trained like one."
Will leaned back against the wall.
"Did that order of Misericord blades come in, Thomas? I've been running into a certain amount of Shaq's demons lately, and I need something narrow that can pierce armored carapaces."
Thomas started to say something to Will about shipping being delayed due to weather in Idris, but Tessa's attention had been distracted by something else. It was a tall box of golden wood, polished to a high shine, with a pattern burned into the front. A snake swallowing its own tail.
"Isn't that the Dark Sister's symbol?" she demanded. "What's it doing here?"
"Not quite," said Will. "The box is a pyxis. Demons don't have souls. Their consciousness comes from a sort of energy, which can sometimes be trapped and stored. The pyxis contains them safely. Oh, and the design is an Ouroboros, the tail devourer. It's an ancient alchemical symbol meant to represent the different dimensions, our world inside the serpent and the rest of existence outside." He shrugged. "The sister's symbol is the first time I've seen anyone draw an Ouroboros with two snakes." "Oh, no, you don't," he added as Tessa reached for the box. He deftly stepped in front of her. "The pyxis can't be touched by anyone who isn't a shadow hunter. Nasty things will happen. Now let's go. We've taken up enough of Thomas's time."
"I don't mind," Thomas protested, but Will was already on his way out.
Tessa glanced back at Thomas from the doorway. He'd gone back to polishing the weaponry, but there was something about the set of his shoulders that made Tessa think he seemed a little bit lonely. "I didn't realize you let mundanes fight with you," she said to Will after they'd left the weapons room behind. "Is Thomas a servant, or..."
"Thomas has been with the Institute for almost his entire life," Will said, guiding Tessa around a sharp turn in the corridor. "There are families who have the sight in their veins, families who have always served shadow hunters. Thomas's parents served Charlotte's parents in the Institute, and now Thomas serves Charlotte and Henry, and his children will serve theirs. Thomas does everything, drives, cares for Balios and Xanthos, those are our horses, and helps with the weapons. Sophie and Agatha manage the rest, though Thomas assists them on occasion. I suspect he's sweet on Sophie and doesn't like to see her work too hard." Tessa was glad to hear it. She felt awful about her reaction to Sophie's scar, and the thought that Sophie had a male admirer, and a handsome one at that, eased her conscience slightly.
"Perhaps he's in love with Agatha," she said.
"I hope not. I intend to marry Agatha myself. She may be 1,000 years old, but she makes an incomparable jam tart. Beauty fades, but cooking is eternal."
He paused in front of a door, big and oak, with thick brass hinges.
"Here we are now," he said, and the door swung open at his touch. The room they entered was bigger even than the ballroom she had seen before. It was longer than it was wide, with rectangular oak tables set down the middle of it, vanishing up to the far wall, which was painted with an image of an angel.
Each table was illuminated by a glass lamp that flickered white. Halfway up the walls was an interior gallery with a wooden railing running around it that could be reached by means of spiral staircases on either side of the room. Rows upon rows of bookshelves stood at intervals, like sentries forming alcoves on either side of the room. There were more bookshelves upstairs as well. The books inside were hidden behind screens of fretted metal, each screen stamped with the pattern of four C's. Huge, outward-curving stained glass windows lined with worn stone benches were set at intervals between the shelves. A vast tome had been left out on a stand, its pages open and inviting. Tessa moved toward it, thinking it must be a dictionary, only to find that its pages were scrolled with illegible, illuminated script and etched with unfamiliar-looking maps.
"This is the Great Library," said Will. "Every institute has a library, but this one is the largest of them all. The largest in the West, at any rate."
He leaned against the door, his arms crossed over his chest.
"I said I would get you more books, didn't I?"
Tessa was so startled that he remembered what he had said that it took her several seconds to respond.
"But the books are all behind bars," she said.
"Like a literary sort of prison." Will grinned.
"Some of these books are dangerous," he said. "It's wise to be careful."
"One must always be careful of books," said Tessa, "and what is inside them, for words have the power to change us."
"I'm not sure a book has ever changed me," said Will.
"Well, there is one volume that promises to teach one how to turn oneself into an entire flock of sheep. Only the very weak-minded refuse to be influenced by literature and poetry," said Tessa, determined not to let him run wildly off with the conversation.
"Of course, why one would want to be an entire flock of sheep is another matter entirely," Will finished.
"Is there something you want to read here, Miss Gray, or is there not? Name it, and I shall attempt to free it from its prison for you."
"Do you think the library has The Wide, Wide World? Or Little Women?"
"Never heard of either of them," said Will.
"We haven't many novels."
"Well, I want novels," said Tessa.
"Or poetry. Books are for reading, not for turning oneself into livestock."
Will's eyes glittered.
"I think we may have a copy of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland about somewhere."
Tessa wrinkled her nose.
"Oh, that's for little children, isn't it?" she said. "I never liked it much. Seemed like so much nonsense."
Will's eyes were very blue.
"There's plenty of sense in nonsense sometimes, if you wish to look for it."
But Tessa had already spied a familiar volume on a shelf and went over to greet it like an old friend.
"Oliver Twist!" she cried. "Have you any other of Mr. Dickens' novels?"
She clasped her hands together.
"Oh, do you have A Tale of Two Cities?"
"That silly thing? Men going around getting their heads chopped off for love? Ridiculous." Will unpeeled himself from the door and made his way toward Tessa, where she stood by the bookshelves. He gestured expansively at the vast number of volumes all around him.
"No, here you'll find all sorts of advice about how to chop off someone else's head if you need to. Much more useful."
"I don't," Tessa protested.
"Need to chop off anyone's head, that is.
And what's the point of a lot of books no one actually wants to read? Haven't you really any other novels?"
"Not unless Lady Audley's secret is that she slays demons in her spare time."
Will bounded up onto one of the ladders and yanked a book off the shelf.
"I'll find you something else to read. Catch!"
He let it fall without looking, and Tessa had to dart forward to seize it before it hit the floor. It was a large squarish volume bound in dark blue velvet. There was a pattern cut into the velvet, a swirling symbol reminiscent of the marks that decorated Will's skin. The title was stamped on the front in silver. The Shadow Hunter's Codex. Tessa glanced up at Will.
"What is this?"
"I assumed you'd have questions about shadow hunters, given that you're currently inhabiting our sanctum sanctorum, so to speak. That book ought to tell you anything you want to know. About us, about our history, even about downworlders like you."
Will's face turned grave. Be careful with it, though. It's 600 years old and the only copy of its kind. Losing or damaging it is punishable by death under the law.
Tessa thrust the book away from her as if it were on fire. You can't be serious.
You're right, I'm not.
Will leapt down from the ladder and landed lightly in front of her.
You do believe everything I say, though, don't you? Do I seem unusually trustworthy to you, or are you just a naive sort?
Instead of replying, Tessa scowled at him and stalked across the room toward one of the stone benches inside a window alcove. Throwing herself down onto the seat, she opened the codex and began to read, studiously ignoring Will, even as he moved to sit beside her. She could feel the weight of his gaze on her as she read. The first page of the Nephilim book showed the same image she'd grown used to seeing on the tapestries in the corridors, the angel rising out of the lake, holding a sword in one hand and a cup in the other. Underneath the illustration was a note, "The Angel Raziel and the Mortal Instruments."
"That's how it all began," Will said cheerfully, as if oblivious to the fact that she was ignoring him.
"A summoning spell here, bit of angel blood there, and you've a recipe for indestructible human warriors. You'll never understand us from reading a book, mind you, but it's a start."
"Hardly human. More like avenging angels," Tessa said softly, turning the pages.
There were dozens of pictures of angels, tumbling out of the sky, shedding feathers as a star might shed sparks as it fell. There were more images of the angel Raziel, holding open a book on whose pages runes burned like fire, and there were men kneeling around him, men on whose skin marks could be seen. Images of men like the one she'd seen in her nightmare with missing eyes and sewed shut lips. Images of shadow hunters brandishing flaming swords like warrior angels out of heaven. She looked up at Will.
"You are, then, aren't you? Part angel."
Will didn't answer. He was looking out the window through a clear lower pane. Tessa followed his gaze. The window gave out onto what had to be the front of the Institute, for there was a rounded courtyard below them surrounded by walls. Through the bars of a high iron gate surmounted by a curved arch, she could glimpse a bit of the street beyond, lit by dim yellow gaslight. There were iron letters worked into the wrought arch atop the gate. When looked at from this direction, they were backward, and Tessa squinted to decipher them.
"Pulvis et umbra sumus."
It's a line from Horace.
"We are dust and shadows."
"Appropriate, don't you think?" Will said.
"It's not a long life, killing demons. One tends to die young, and then they burn your body, dust to dust in the literal sense. And then we vanish into the shadows of history, nary a mark on the page of a mundane book to remind the world that once we existed at all."
Tessa looked at him. He was wearing that look she found so odd and compelling. That amusement that didn't seem to pass beyond the surface of his features, as if he found everything in the world both infinitely funny and infinitely tragic all at the same time. She wondered what had made him this way, how he had come to find darkness amusing, for it was a quality he didn't appear to share with any of the other shadow hunters she had met, however briefly. Perhaps it was something he had learned from his parents. But what parents? "Don't you ever worry," she said softly, "that what's out there might come in here?"
"Demons and other unpleasantness, you mean?"
Will asked, though Tessa wasn't sure if that was what she had meant, or if she had been speaking of the evils of the world in general. He placed a hand against the wall. "The mortar that made these stones was mixed with the blood of shadow hunters. Every beam is carved of rowan wood. Every nail used to hammer the beams together is made of silver, iron, or electrum. The place is built on hallowed ground, surrounded by wards. The front door can be opened only by one possessing shadow hunter blood, otherwise it remains locked forever.
This place is a fortress. So no, I'm not worried.
But why live in a fortress?
At his surprised look, she elaborated. You clearly aren't related to Charlotte and Henry. They're hardly old enough to have adopted you. And not all Shadow Hunter children must live here, or there would be more than you and Jessamine.
And Jem, Will reminded her.
Yes, but you see what I mean? Why don't you live with your family? None of us have parents. Jessamine's died in a fire. Jem came from quite a distance away to live here after his parents were murdered by demons. Under Covenant law, the Clave is responsible for parentless Shadow Hunter children under the age of 18.
So you are one another's family?
If you must romanticize it, I suppose we are. All brothers and sisters under the Institute's roof. You as well, Miss Gray, however temporarily.
In that case, Tessa said, feeling hot blood rise to her face, I think I would prefer it if you would call me by my Christian name, as you do with Miss Lovelace.
Will looked at her, slow and hard, and then smiled. His blue eyes lit when he smiled.
Then you must do the same for me, he said. Tessa.
She had never thought about her name much before, but when he said it, it was as if she were hearing it for the first time. The hard T, the caress of the double S, the way it seemed to end on a breath. Her own breath was very short when she said softly, Will.
Yes?
Amusement glittered in his eyes. With a sort of horror, Tessa realized that she had simply said his name for the sake of saying it. She hadn't actually had a question. Hastily, she said, How do you learn to fight like you do? To draw those magical symbols and the rest of it. Will smiled. We had a tutor who provided our schooling and physical training, though he's left for Idris and Charlotte's looking for a replacement, along with Charlotte, who takes care of teaching us history and ancient languages.
So she's your governess?
A look of dark mirth passed across Will's features.
You could say that. But I wouldn't call Charlotte a governess if I were you, not if you want to preserve your limbs intact.
You wouldn't think it to look at her, but she's quite skilled with a variety of weapons, our Charlotte. Tessa blinked in surprise.
You don't mean... Charlotte doesn't fight, does she?
Not the way you and Henry do.
Certainly she does. Why wouldn't she?
Because she's a woman, Tessa said.
So was Boadicea.
Who?
So the queen, Boadicea, standing loftily charioted, brandishing in her hand a dart and rolling glances lioness-like.
Will broke off at Tessa's look of incomprehension and grinned.
Nothing?
If you were English, you'd know. Remind me to find a book about her for you. Regardless, she was a powerful warrior queen. When she was finally defeated, she took poison rather than let herself be captured by the Romans. She was braver than any man. I like to think Charlotte is much in the same mold, if somewhat smaller.
But she can't be any good at it, can she? I mean, women don't have those sort of feelings.
What kind of feelings are those?
Bloodlust, I suppose, Tessa said after a moment.
Fierceness, warrior feelings.
I saw you waving that hacksaw at the Dark Sisters, Will pointed out. And if I recall correctly... Lady Audley's secret was, in fact, that she was a murderer.
So you've read it. Tessa couldn't hide her delight.
He looked amused.
I prefer The Trail of the Serpent. More adventure, less domestic drama. Neither is as good as The Moonstone, though. Have you read Collins?
I adore Wilkie Collins, Tessa cried. Oh, Armandale! And The Woman in White?
Are you laughing at me?
Not at you, said Will, grinning. More because of you. I've never seen anyone get so excited over books before.
You'd think they were diamonds.
Well, they are, aren't they? Isn't there something you love like that? And don't say spats or lawn tennis or something silly.
Good Lord, he said with mock horror. It's like she knows me already.
Everyone has something they can't live without. I'll find out what it is for you, never you fear.
She meant to speak lightly, but at the look on his face, her voice trailed off into uncertainty. He was looking at her with an odd steadiness. His eyes were the same dark blue as the velvet binding of the book she held. His gaze passed over her face, down her throat, to her waist, before rising back up to her face where it lingered on her mouth. Tessa's heart was pounding as if she had been running upstairs. Something in her chest ached, as if she were hungry or thirsty. There was something she wanted, but she didn't know what. "It's late," Will said abruptly, looking away from her. "I should show you back to your room." "I..." Tessa wanted to protest, but there was no reason to do so. He was right, it was late. The pinprick light of stars visible through the clear panes of the window. She rose to her feet, cradling the book to her chest, and went with Will out into the corridor. "There are a few tricks to learning your way around the Institute that I ought to teach you," he said, still not looking at her. There was something oddly diffident in his attitude now that hadn't been there moments before, as if Tessa had done something to offend him. But what could she have done? "Ways to identify the different doors and turn..." He broke off, and Tessa saw that someone was coming down the corridor toward them. It was Sophie, a basket of laundry tucked under one of her arms. Seeing Will and Tessa, she paused, her expression growing more guarded. "Sophie," Will's diffidence turned to mischief, "have you finished putting my room in order yet?"
"It's done."
Sophie didn't return his smile. "It was filthy. I hope that in future you can refrain from tracking bits of dead demon through the house." Tessa's mouth fell open. How could Sophie talk to Will like that? She was a servant, and he, even if he was younger than she was a gentleman. And yet Will seemed to take it in stride. "All part of the job, young Sophie."
"Mr. Bramwell and Mr. Carstairs seem to have no problem cleaning their boots," Sophie said, looking darkly from Will to Tessa. "Perhaps you could learn from their example."
"Perhaps," said Will, "but I doubt it." Sophie scowled and started off along the corridor again, her shoulders tightly set with indignation. Tessa looked at Will in amazement.
"What was that?"
Will shrugged lazily. "Sophie enjoys pretending she doesn't like me."
"Doesn't like you? She hates you."
Under other circumstances, she might have asked if Will and Sophie had had a falling out, but one didn't fall out with servants. If they were unsatisfactory, one ceased to employ them.
Did something happen between you?"
"Tessa," Will said with exaggerated patience.
"Enough. There are things you can't hope to understand."
If there was one thing Tessa hated, it was being told that there were things she couldn't understand. Because she was young, because she was a girl, for any of a thousand reasons that never seemed to make any real sense. She set her chin stubbornly. "Well, not if you won't tell me. But then I'd have to say that it looks a great deal like she hates you because you did something awful to her." Will's expression darkened. "You can think what you like. It's not as if you know anything about me. I know you don't like giving straightforward answers to questions. I know you're probably around 17. I know you like Tennyson. You quoted him at the Dark House, and again just now. I know you're an orphan, as I am."
"I never said I was an orphan."
Will spoke with unexpected savagery. "And I loathe poetry. So as it happens, you really don't know anything about me at all, do you?" And with that, he spun on his heel and walked away. 5. The Shadow Hunter's Codex. "Dreams are true while they last, and do we not live in dreams?" Alfred, Lord Tennyson. The Higher Pantheism. It took an age of wandering glumly from corridor to identical corridor before Tessa, by lucky chance, recognized a rip in yet another of the endless tapestries and realized that the door to her bedroom must be one of the ones lining that particular hallway. A few minutes of trial and error later,
and she was gratefully shutting the correct door behind her and sliding the bolt home in the lock. The moment she was back in her nightgown and had slipped under the covers, she opened the Shadow Hunter's Codex and began to read.